Justice delayed is justice denied.
I'm MK Anderson, and this is First 100 Days. A podcast where we discuss the idea that if the first 100 days of a presidency are so important, they're likely to be important for anybody else's career and life moves. We'll talk to CEOs, first-time parents, startup bros, and more to discover if the first 100 days are really that important. Today, we're chatting with Judge Wayne Anderson. He currently serves as a mediator and arbitrator for JAMS in Chicago, but not without his time in Illinois politics as the Deputy Secretary of State and, of course, becoming a federal court judge appointed under President George H.W. Bush. I'm excited to learn all that goes into the appointment process and what you can expect your first 100 days working in the United States District Court. Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to chat with us today.
It's my pleasure.
And just as a disclaimer, this is my dad, and that is the first time I have formally called him Judge. But before we get into what the appointment process looks like, has this been something that has been on your radar since the beginning? Because you did go to law school immediately after undergrad.
So when I was in eighth grade, graduating from elementary school, our school newspaper, the Oriole Park Warbler, said that all the eighth graders had to say what they wanted to be when they grew up. And I was past wanting to be a zookeeper or a fireman, and I wasn't sure. But I had a real good friend whose dad was a lawyer, so I put down lawyer. And then every time I mentioned something different after that, my mother would look at me, point her finger, and said, "You said you were going to be a lawyer." So I always knew from eighth grade on that I wanted to be a lawyer. And part of the reason was because I really wanted to be involved in government. And so in those days, I graduated from college in 1967. In those days, pretty much everybody went straight from college to graduate school if you were going to go to graduate school. People didn't take time off like they do now oftentimes. But I really did not aspire to be a judge. I actually aspired to run for other offices and be involved in government. And I had enough of a taste of that. So I really knew I liked government and government policy.
And when you meant that you had a taste for that, what did that look like? What were the different political things you had done?
So when I got out, when I got fresh out of law school, I went to work as an intern in the Illinois General Assembly. In those days, they had almost no staff. In fact, the staff that I started to work under was fired when there was a change of leadership. So as an intern, I stayed on because I was technically a student. So I got to do a lot of really exciting things. I wrote some of which are still in session. I got to be parliamentarian of the House of Representatives for a day. Or it was longer than that on paper, but we only met once or twice. So I laughingly call myself parliamentarian for a day. But I got to learn a lot about dealing with different groups of people, solving problems, all tied in with government policy. And that was really fun.
So then did you want to run for office, or did you still want to be a lawyer and work in a legislative role a different way?
So after that, if you get into a political job like I was in, sooner or later, you're going to get fired. So I beat them to the punch. There was a political change of winds. So I retired before they could fire me. And then I went to work for a law firm. And I was an associate, which is a lower level lawyer in a firm. And then I became a partner in the firm. And I did that for a total of 8 years, practicing the general practice of law. And that was fine. But I always kind of had an itch to get back into government policy making. And so when a friend of mine was appointed to be the Illinois Secretary of State, which in Illinois is a major office that encompasses lots of different unrelated divisions, he asked me to be Deputy Secretary of State. So I quit practicing law and I went to do that. And I really enjoyed that as well. And I did that for about 4 years.
So then every time you took on a new role, were you thinking about what would be the next thing? Because you mentioned you're bound to get, you know, cycled through or someone else gets elected. So what came after then being Secretary of State or Deputy Secretary of State?
Good point. So I thought, aha, I'm going to help the guy who was my friend who appointed me to get elected at the next election and work hard for it. And then when that's over, I'm going to decide to run for office myself. So he did get reelected. And then I, while still working there, I had gotten to know lots of people, decided to lay the groundwork to run for a major office in Cook County. Now, I was a Republican, and there aren't very many offices Republicans can win in Cook County. But candidates never have a clear vision of what's going on. So I thought I had a chance. And I had really gotten the support. And at the last minute, the Republican Party leaders in Cook County decided they wanted somebody else to run. But the rank and file liked me and supported me, and they wanted to appease them. So they said to me, gee, if you would step aside from running for the office you want to run for and nominate at our convention the guy we want, then we will support you running for judge. And I hadn't really wanted to be a judge because judges normally cannot be proactive in deciding public policy. You decide cases on a one-on-one basis that come before you. But I was upset. I didn't want to abandon this great effort that they were going to take away from me without getting something of value. And a friend of mine who had become a judge said, Wayne, look, you can quit anytime you want, but if you last for just 2 weeks, they got to call you judge the rest of your life. little did he know that my own daughter, 30 or 40 years later, would be interviewing me, calling me judge herself. It's pretty cool. In any event, I said I would run, and I ran for a state court judge. And in Illinois, state court judges are elected on a partisan basis. And I ran from a district, suburban Cook County, where a Republican could be elected. So I was elected to be a state court judge. And then when I became a judge, I discovered one day I was happy. And I thought, why? Exactly. Why am I happy? So I went home. So I thought, hey, this being a judge is pretty cool. And so I discovered then that even though I had not aspired to be a judge, I really actually enjoyed it. And about several years later, some congressman said to me, you know, you ought to become a federal judge because you're pretty young and the president would like to get them young. And why don't you give that a shot? So I decided to do that about 4 years or so after becoming a state court judge.
And can you give a little bit of a time frame there? What year are we talking about right now?
So I got elected in 1984 to be a state court judge. And we must have had that conversation in about, yes, it was in early 1988. At that time, Ronald Reagan was the Republican president, so Republicans had a fairly good chance to be appointed to be a federal judge. And I figured I had a good shot at that. But the process moves really slowly, and I knew it would be after the 1988 election that I would have a chance. Well, in August of 1988, right before the Democratic convention, Michael Dukakis was 21 points ahead of George Bush in the polls. And I thought, well, I'll never get in because Dukakis will win, serve two terms, and by then I'll probably be too old and they won't want to pick me. But miraculously, Bush made a big comeback. He won the election handily. So right after the election, I called Congressman Henry Hyde, who I had worked for way back in the General Assembly, and we had maintained a really good friendship. And he became chairman of the House Judiciary Committee ultimately and became a famous legislator. And I asked him, I said, Congressman, would you sponsor me before the president and see if I could get nominated to be a federal judge? And he said he would.
So before we talk about what the nomination and vetting process is like, do you mind talking a little bit about what it means to have party affiliation as a judge? Because my natural inclination is that I can't see a difference between how they act in a courtroom because they're just enacting the law. But what do you think?
It turns out, I don't think it's very important in the decisions that judges make. So I had that same question when I became a judge, both state and federal. And I wondered, because the world talks about party affiliation, and like now, President Trump is getting all these federal judges in, will that actually make a big difference in terms of policy? So I've been watching that carefully. Once you get on the bench, if you're on a trial bench, as I was, trying individual cases and solving individual problems, I've never been able to discern that a person's political affiliation makes a difference. However, the people who pick them, whether they're elected by voters or appointed by presidents themselves are political. So sometimes the people who do the picking care about your past political affiliation when they decide who to pick as being a judge.
But even if your past affiliation is one party or the other, does that even have a say in how you end up ruling on cases at all?
I cannot think of any case that I ever had where I think my party affiliation made any difference at all. And I've watched my colleagues on the bench pretty carefully because I wondered, does it make a difference there? And I have to tell you, I have never found a pattern that can be explained by party affiliation. I think among judges, there's radical differences in terms of temperament and conscientiousness. And I think within each political group, whether they're Republicans or Democrats when they get appointed, there's a full range of personalities. And that accounts for the variables on the bench, not their political affiliations.
So then, do you mind talking about the process of what it looked like to be appointed or sponsored? Or I don't even know what the verb is to become.
So
judge.
Under the U.S. Constitution, the president gets to appoint the judges. However, they have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And so I'm going to guess back under President Washington, Washington said to the Senate, I want to make sure my nominations are confirmed by you. How can I do that? And they said to him, well, Mr. President, if you appoint the people we tell you to appoint, then we will confirm them, which makes sense. So in the United States, at the trial court level, the district court level, the senior senator of the president's party traditionally has the prerogative of choosing nominees and presenting them to the president. The president can accept them or reject them, but I can't think of any situation I know where a president himself actually reached out and picked a nominee at the district court level. At the appellate court level, which is more policymaking, it's more back and forth with the senators and the president. And at the Supreme Court level, it's generally considered to be the president gets to pick whoever he wants. And then the Senate, though, gets a free shot at confirming them or not. So in my case, there were no Republican senators, even though there was a Republican president, no Republican senators from Illinois. So that power devolved to the senior Republican in Congress in the House, which was a guy named Bob Michael from Peoria. He didn't know that much about the Chicago area, so he turned to Henry Hyde and said, Henry, who would you nominate for judge here? And Henry suggested me, as well as some other people, for vacancies. I then, because the Senate got to confirm me, before I was even nominated, I was interviewed by both Senator Simon and Senator Dixon, who are Democrats, because there's no point in nominating somebody if you're president unless the senators are going to approve them, because any senator can block a nomination. So they met with me. They approved me, even though I was not of their party. They thought I was competent, and I got nominated by the president. In fact, the president himself called me. I was at work, and he called one day after this process was almost over and said, Judge Anderson, I'm considering nominating you for this vacancy on the federal court in Chicago. Would you accept? And I said, of course, and I'll try to do a really good job, so you'd be proud of me. And then I got worried about other people who had been waiting. It took 3 years to get to me that were waiting. And so he took a breath, and I wanted him to get to the next person on the list and not waste his time. So I hung up.
Oh, no.
And then I thought, exactly. And then I thought, holy cow. But the word in my mind was not cow. Yeah. I hung up on the president. So I know it was crazy. So I was profoundly relieved the next day to see the announcement in the newspapers. In fact, he had signed the papers for me that day. And I might add that along the way, before I ultimately became a federal judge, I was subjected to, I would say, 11 different investigations by legal groups, political groups, the FBI. The FBI was the most incredible thing. So my favorite question they asked was, have you done anything in the past 20 years to attempt the violent overthrow of the government of the United States? If so, please explain.
Right.
So, I figure they use the same form for counter-spy applications mm-hmm. as well. But anyhow, I got through the whole process, went to Washington for a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, got confirmed, and then the president signs a commission. And now you've been through the ringer so long. I heard like one morning that he had signed my commission. So at lunch, I quit my job as a state court judge, walked down the street, raised my right hand, and became a federal judge, which is a lifetime appointment.
But before we talk about what it was like to set foot into your new office, what were some of those questions that they were asking you during the vetting period? Because I just have no idea what they could ask. Like, did they ask if you were nice or not, or what your voting history was when you were in public office? Yeah.
Well, first of all, they know the people who are there speaking for you. So in my case, both Henry Hyde, who rarely appeared in the Senate, so that caused a big stir because he was one of the most famous members of Congress. So when he came over to the Senate to actually speak for me, staffers and other people gathered just to look at him and hear him speak, since he's a great speaker. So fortunately, his speaking for me used up a lot of my time, so they couldn't ask me as many questions. And then the U.S. senators, who were Democrats, were there, and they spoke briefly for me. So that took most of the time. The only question, I watched other interviews, and for appellate courts, they may ask a lot of legal questions about cases they had. But the only question I can remember is that Senator Leahy, who's still there, he's a senator from Vermont, a Democrat, he said, I read your materials when you were running the Chicago Traffic Court. You said that after every court call, you asked anybody who had been entangled in driver's license problems to stick around so that you could help them untangle that. Is that true? And I said, yes, it is true, because it really messes up the lives of ordinary people if they don't have a driver's license. And because I had worked with the Secretary of State in Illinois, who issues the licenses, I could explain to them and what they had to do to get them back. And I think what he really wanted to know was I going to be the kind of judge who cared about people? I think that was the essence of that question. And frankly, I think that is maybe the most important quality you should look for in a judge.
So what did the onboarding process look like once you were officially appointed?
Well, the first thing they do is they ship you about 300 cases. They're at different stages. So the first day you walk into the office, you have a pile of 300 cases that are now yours. And they're on every imaginable subject under the world, because federal judges don't hear specialized cases. Many state court judges hear cases of one type, like divorce or car crashes or criminal cases. But federal judges get a sampling of the full array of all the lawsuits filed in federal court. So I had this 5-foot stack of files on my desk and in every imaginable type of case. So the first thing a federal judge does usually is hire 2 or nowadays 3 law clerks, really smart young lawyers, sometimes coming out of law school, sometimes with a couple years of experience, who are great writers, who like to do research, and can help you, or in my case, me, start going through those cases and understand what they're about and see which ones need urgent attention and which ones, let's say, the lawyers and the parties are going to be working on for the next 6 months and don't need a judge's attention. And then I also had to pick then an administrative assistant or a secretary and a court reporter, as well as being able to have some modest allowance to kind of furnish the chambers that I had. So at the very beginning, I got the law clerks, picked the staff, and picked out a little bit of furniture. As you know from growing up with me, Mary, my taste in furniture is not elegant and particularly good. So I found somebody else to figure out the best color scheme. But then you have it for the rest of your life if you stay forever.
Right.
So it's a kind of a one shot. You could get what you want, and then you take it from there. But interestingly, you have no boss. There is no boss. So usually when you start a new job, you go to somebody who is your boss, and you say, how do I do this, or what should I do? And when you're a federal judge, you don't have a boss. So you're really on your own. I knew that would be the case, so I also became friends quickly with a couple of other judges so that when I had a problem, I could pick up the phone or walk down to their chambers and ask a question.
From what I can remember, you had a lot of cases that were trial by jury. So then what is the role of a judge or a federal court judge in this particular instance in those types of cases when really the decision is being made by a jury?
So in a jury trial, first of all, almost all the criminal cases in federal court are with juries, and a lot of the civil cases are as well. So in a jury trial, the job of the judge is to, A, referee the behavior of people in the courtroom and make sure it moves forward on an orderly basis, B, oversee the selection of a jury that's going to be fair and not biased one way or the other, and C, give the jury proper legal instructions so that they know what their legal guide is when they actually decide the case after all the evidence and closing arguments have been put on. And I think it's a very important for the judge to set the right tone of the proceedings so that they move forward at a reasonable pace, but not so fast that people can't do their best.
So then did it feel different to do this judge work versus other work that you had done before?
The jury trial is the same in pretty much, I would say, every court in the United States. It's the same feeling. But the jury trials in 52 weeks of the year, I would say I would spend an average of maybe 4 to 8 weeks on jury trials. Now, I did have a couple that were 10-week trials, but generally speaking, on the actual trials with the jury in the box, 2 or 3 months of the year would be a lot. So the rest of the time, I'm either hearing things from the bench or many times in federal court, and you probably didn't notice it at the time, but every evening I would bring a pile of papers home and work my way through those papers because a huge amount of decisions are made in lawsuits based on the written papers that lawyers submit to the judge. So I probably spent as much or more time doing that as anything else. Plus, I think people should have a chance to work out their differences. So I would tell parties, you're not going to go to trial unless you come in and we have a settlement conference to see if you can work it out. And so I spent a lot of times working on settlement conferences. Oftentimes I did them at 8 a.m. That was because it didn't interfere with other things. I would leave at about 7 o'clock and meet people in my chambers at about 8 a.m. and find out whether or not they had a chance to settle the case. And I hoped that by 9 or 9:30 and people started coming into the courtroom, that I would either settle the case, no, I couldn't settle the case, or realize what we had to continue to do to settle it.
So was this something that you had explicitly thought about before you had taken the bench? Or what were some of those goals that you did set?
It was interesting. I did not have any philosophical goals at all, other than to be fair. And I also felt from my time as a state court judge that going to court is incredibly stressful, particularly for regular people or the parties in a lawsuit, but a lot of times even for the lawyers. And I felt I want to set a tone where people do not feel stressed, even though they're in a courtroom. So I didn't have an ideological axe to grind, but I wanted to try to set a tone of civility and welcomingness so that people could do a better job and felt that and would feel that no matter how the decision came out, they got a fair shot. So that was really my main goal. And I'd say I began to feel that way when I was a state court judge, and I carried that to the federal bench. I also did not want to get too far behind. Justice delayed is justice denied. So on the one hand, I wanted to keep cases moving along. On the other hand, in civil lawsuits, the public's interest is not usually involved. So I wanted to make sure the lawyers and the parties had a chance to move at the pace that they felt they needed to move at to do the right job and not necessarily be pushing them too much. So that's an interesting balance that I'd say every judge learns about as he or she matures as a judge.
So then would you say that your first moments on the bench were defining, or do you think that it was just something you figured out as you went along?
Good question. First of all, the first moments are really defining because you imagine before you become a judge that somehow judges are going to be wise and think about it and able to make correct decisions. But one discovers right off the bat that a lot of times you have to make a decision without knowing really what the facts are. For example, most judges like me started out in a state traffic court, and your first case is the light red or green? And the police officer says it's red, and the driver says it's green, and then they look up at you for the answer. Wow, you don't know. So you quickly realize, or you should realize, that the world looks up to you to make a decision, and you have to make decisions that are as fair as possible, but many times without knowing really what the truth is. And so that is something that nobody appreciates until they're in that position. I don't know anybody who does, no matter what they tell you. And I've been a judge long enough, so several hundred people became judges who I knew right after they became a judge, and I helped them through that process. So that was totally new. And then I also had decided when I was a practicing lawyer and had judges who didn't understand cases well tell me what to do, that if I became a judge, I was not going to try to micromanage their case for them. As long as they're being conscientious and diligent, I would, as they say, call balls and strikes and do my best on any issue presented to me without trying to be overly intrusive.
And do you think that then set the tone for the rest of your time on the bench, or did you end up like adopting other things or learning more about it?
Well, you always learn different things. But in terms of the big principles, I would say that was it. I wanted to create an atmosphere that was not stressful, if possible, so that people could do their best. And I didn't want to be overly intrusive in other people's disputes. Where cases involve the public interest, which harkened back to my legislative experience, for example, I really did feel a separate responsibility. So there's certain kinds of lawsuits that you know are going to have a broader impact on society, and those really require a lot of thought. And then if you're a federal judge, I think the world is entitled to have your explanation for why you decide to decide the case the way that you do. And I enjoyed that, and that was sometimes hard, but it's really important to society.
Well, what were some of the implications that your job had on the public?
Yeah, I'd say I had a couple cases that had a substantial public impact. One was what's called the Shackman case. Michael Shackman was a young, newly minted lawyer who decided to run for office and discovered that the Democratic machine in Cook County would not let any city workers campaign for him, and indeed ordered city workers to campaign for his opponent. And so he filed a lawsuit in 1969 that, by the way, is still going. And he said it is not right for government to force regular government workers using government power to work for or against particular political candidates, or ultimately to base their employment for the government on what they do for political parties. And I actually inherited that lawsuit and had it for like the last 10 years I was a federal judge. And during that period of time, we got several large agencies like the City of Chicago, the County of Cook, the Cook County Sheriff, other major institutions of government to begin to depoliticize the hiring, firing, transfer, promotion, and punishment of employees. And I think that's had an enormous impact. Indeed, I think that that has taken the patronage politics out of people running for office, so that, for example, our current mayor, Lori Lightfoot, would not have had a chance in the old patronage politics day. But now anybody has a fair chance without armies of government workers working against them. And so I think that has had a major impact. That lawsuit is still going on and still doing a lot of good with other government agencies. I had a second lawsuit which involved serious crime in Chicago public housing. And in that lawsuit, if there was a lot of gang shooting, sometimes people were firing at window washers, the Chicago Housing Authority and the police here would get together a posse, surround a whole building, and then search all the apartments for guns and drugs. And that sounded like it was a really good response to the crime that was really getting out of hand. So the ACLU filed a lawsuit saying, aha, you can't search people's apartments unless you get a warrant or you get their permission. And a lot of tenant housing presidents were in favor of that lawsuit because they were desperate for police protection. And I have to say, when that lawsuit began, when I first got it, I thought they have a good point. We can't tolerate this. But then we had hearings for a number of days, and I discovered that the CHA police were incompetent. The people who ran the CHA said they were. The posses never arrived at the building till an average of 2 or 3 days after an incident had occurred, and somehow the gang leaders found out and would put up signs saying this building to be searched on Saturday morning. So they never ever found guns or drugs. But what they did do was barge into the apartment of a lot of people who hadn't done anything wrong. So I enjoined that. I issued an order saying the police may not search these apartments without getting a warrant, which, by the way, in Chicago is pretty easy to get. At that point in time, and I said, well, the way they ought to solve this is by doing a better police job to begin with, or as they've ultimately done, get rid of a lot of these high-rise projects altogether. But in any event, when I issued that ruling, the Guardian Angels picketed the building against me, claimed I like gangbangers. Actually, I walked through their picket line. They didn't recognize me, so I could walk right through it. And President Clinton attacked me, and the then-Mayor Daley attacked me, claiming I was pro-crime. But interestingly enough, the New York Times ran an editorial saying, don't mess with Judge Anderson, because he's standing up for people's rights. And ultimately, after they thought about it, the city and the CHA and the Justice Department in Washington all asked me to make my order permanent. The CHA police were abolished. The Chicago police started regularly patrolling those things. And I think there was less crime as a result. So that was really interesting. But I was at the eye of a storm. But my position as a lifetime appointed federal judge meant that I was not at all worried about the political implications or the bad statements that were going to be said about me by powerful presidents or powerful politicians and government officials. In fact, some of my friends said, aren't you worried because President Clinton and Mayor Daley have attacked you? And I said, no, that's why I have life tenure. I could do what I think is right under the law, and they're either going to have to appeal and get me reversed, or they're going to have to do what I say. And ultimately, they thought about it, decided to do what I said, and that was really exciting, and I think we made a positive difference.
Well, that's just also an interesting flip of the coin, because a lot of people can think of a lifetime appointed position as also negative, right? Because then people have the ability to get away with negative things as opposed to doing what's right and not be worried about getting kicked off.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. That's a major debate in this country. If you want judges not to be subject to political influence, you give them life tenure. But on the other hand, if they're not doing a good job and they're doing something really bad, they can last doing it forever and there's nothing you can do about it. So the states, in some states you have appointed judges, in some states you have elected judges. In almost all states, you could get the judges out of office so they don't serve for life for lots of reasons. But under the U.S. Constitution, they have a right to serve for life. So they've really tilted in favor of what we call independence of the judiciary.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us. Was there anything that you think would be important to know, and especially for those who are trying to take a more active role in electing judges and electing their officials?
Well, people should be active. So I say you have no right to complain about people in office unless you've been active in doing it. But the best advice I could ever give anybody is to listen to all of these podcasts. They're put on by a phenomenal person, MK Anderson.
Thanks, Dad.
You're all welcome. Right. I love you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of First 100 Days. Original music by Dan Chmielinski, and feel free to tell your friends. Bye, y'all.